is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Turkey, a runoff in Turkey. What we have now is the man in charge for 23 years came within a half a percentage points of claiming victory in the presidential contest in Turkey in the first round. 49.5% is the report. He will face the leader of the opposition, the 74-year-old Kılıçdaroğlu, for the runoff in some week's time. In the meantime, it is wise to assess what the world is with Erdogan and what it would be without him, not from the point of view of Europe and the Black Sea Basin, but from the point of view of Central Asia, especially Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Azerbaijan, the Caspian Sea Basin, the riches of Central Asia having to do with natural resources, but also people, Uzbekistan being the most populous state. Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, is here, having recently returned from Tashkent and a successful election, looking to another one where the president is looking to not only vouchsafe the new constitution, but also run for another term under the new constitution. Gregory, a very good evening to you. President Erdogan, what does he mean to Central Asia in general and to Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Azerbaijan in particular? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, President Erdogan has been particularly strenuous in his espousal of Turkish nationalism. And that's important in Central Asia, where most of the people are Turkic-speaking, not necessarily Turkish. In fact, they regard themselves in Central Asia as being the parent of the Turkish people in Turkey, or Turkey, as it's pronounced in Turkish and how they want you to say it now. So the reality is that there's this close bond which has been reinforced by Erdogan. Erdogan has made sure that there has been a lot of investment out of the Turkish businesses and the government into Central Asia. And Ankara has been very positive in supporting the opening of channels, literally land bridges from Turkey to Azerbaijan and across the Caspian into Central Asia. And this is critical going forward because the five Central Asian states plus Azerbaijan are anxious to be able to have means of trading with the outside world which do not involve them having to go across Russia or the People's Republic of China. Russia and the PRC are the biggest trading partners of the Central Asian states because, after all, Russia in particular had been occupying all of these old khanates, the places run by khans and emirs and the like, for over 100 years after the Russian invasion of Central Asian states in the second half of the 19th century. So Turkey is now taking on the role of safeguarding the Central Asian states. And that's important for the West because for the West, the Central Asian independent states, now independent states after the collapse of the Soviet Union, drive a geopolitical wedge up between the Russian Federation and the People's Republic of China. So essentially, something which was not available to the West in the first Cold War is that the Central Asian states now represent a bastion of pro-Western market economies in the region and potentially stand to disrupt the whole new Eurasian military bloc of Russia, PRC, and Iran. And that's why, starting on the 18th, in other words, in a couple of days, we've got a major summit taking place in Xi'an in the People's Republic of China, where five of the Central Asian leaders are now going to meet with Xi Jinping to discuss the future going forward for Central Asia and the People's Republic of China.
I want to contribute what I can from my experience of Mr. Erdogan. I was in Baku in December of 2020 following the conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh. And there was a parade in Baku in the main roadway and along the harbor. No one was invited. There was heavy security, so I watched it on television from my hotel. But Erdogan was there with Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan. There was much congratulating and celebration, genuine celebration, because Turkey had weighed in on Azerbaijan's side with the conflict with Armenia and its backer, Russia. Erdogan was seen as a hero and a man who could lead Azerbaijan, which we know is the most advanced, progressive, and sophisticated of the Central Asian and South Caucasus states because it's developed its oil fields and its natural gas fields. That measure in Baku that day, is that something that's echoed in Tashkent? Is that something that's echoed in Nur-Sultan, the capital of Kazakhstan? Do they also welcome Erdogan's presence?
Not to the degree that has been the case in Azerbaijan. Bear in mind that one of the things that Azerbaijan doesn't and really can't talk about in its recent war with Armenia, or its ongoing war, and for that matter, is that Israel played an equally decisive part in providing technology to upgrade the Azerbaijan armed forces to make them ready for when Armenia revived the war, which it did, as you know, about 18 months ago. But Erdogan is popular in Azerbaijan, not as popular, I think, as the president of Azerbaijan, whose father was the one who literally took former Soviet Azerbaijan towards independence for the Azeri people. But nonetheless, Azerbaijan has a direct trading link with Turkey. Now that the recent war outcome enabled an overland access from metropolitan Azerbaijan, if you want to call it that, from Baku across what was Armenian-occupied parts of Azerbaijan, now down into the exclave, former exclave, to the south, that enables trade to go from the oil fields and gas fields of Baku across Azerbaijan and right to the Turkish border, and therefore out to international markets. And it's this land bridge which is also now being opened up to the Central Asian states. As I say, the Central Asian states welcome the Turkish investment, which I think is not going to continue much longer because Turkey is now a bankrupt state. And it looks as though President Erdogan could well win another term in office with the runoff election on May the 28th. And if he does, he will accelerate the bankruptcy of Turkey, because his policies have literally been the thing which have driven up inflation to 85% in the official statistics last month, now down to 44% this month, but really in all probability well over 100% inflation rate for the year. He's also presided over economic policies which have driven down the value of the Turkish lira, which only a few years ago was almost one-to-one with the US dollar, and now is about 20 to the dollar. So literally the purchasing power of the Turkish voter has been dramatically reduced. And and Erdogan, in the run-up to the election, was doing all manner of little deals to give support and aid to people who were hit by either the earthquake or the inflation or both, so that they would not blame Erdogan for their woes. But in the next year, they are going to feel the full weight of this economic collapse. Now, had the opposition under Kılıçdaroğlu taken over, and there's still a chance that could happen, then what you would see are dramatic attempts to tighten credit and therefore reduce inflation. And this will be also painful and very unpopular, but at least under Kılıçdaroğlu, you'll start to see the economy recover, and you won't see that under Erdogan.
I note that according to the preliminary results of the election, many of the provinces or parts of the country that were affected by the earthquake voted for Erdogan, and the explanation by Reuters was that the vote was because of promises of rebuilding those cities quickly. 50,000 dead, many more hurt, lots of aftershocks, and the rebuild is ahead. Is that sufficient to sustain Erdogan in his next term if he is successful?
No, it's not, because the cost to even basically rebuild the southwest region of Turkey after the earthquake is estimated to be $100 to $150 billion, and that's literally, you know, a sixth to an eighth of the entire Turkish economy. And Turkey has no borrowing power left. Its foreign exchange reserves have dwindled to nothing. It's the value of the lira continues to be in, you know, in Zimbabwean or Argentine terms. In other words, horrifying. So basically, Erdogan will not be able to deliver on his promises. He actually covered up the fact that he delayed any humanitarian response by the armed forces going into the earthquake area to provide relief and to save people's lives. And that was because he was afraid that the military would use the opportunity to overthrow him, which they may well have done. But the reality is that he delayed the humanitarian response. And as a result, there are now at least known to be more than 50,000 Turkish people dead as a result of the earthquake, and millions literally displaced or severely impacted by the crisis. So Erdogan's not going to be able to deliver on his promises. That's the first thing. He may well even compromise on what he does do for the suffering public by continuing to spend on prestige defense programs, which are meant to show the glory of Turkey and its ability to intimidate its neighbors in Syria, Greece, and Israel. There's going to have to be a compromise there, because he's losing any ability to get credit on the international scene.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, commenting on President Erdogan's attempt to win a new term. He's been 23 years in power, and five more years is what he wants. When we come back, however, Turkey is part of, and Central Asia is part of, something called the Great Game, dating to at least the 19th, 18th century. And Gregory's analysis is that it's beginning again. Who are the players? And is the U.S., is Britain, is Europe part of this conversation?